It's 9:06. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'll be here the next couple of weeks. This being 9 on Monday, it's time for All Things Political. Joining me is George Waller, professor of political science at UW Fox Valley. Professor Waller, good morning, and thanks for joining me today.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be with you, John.
Well, let's start with national politics, and the debt ceiling deal is what's kind of sucking all the oxygen out of the political room at the moment. Is the McConnell-Reid plan going anywhere?
Well, you know, it's hard to say what plan is going where. I know they're going to start meeting again this week, and there have been a number of different plans that have been floating out there. It appears as though the $4 trillion plan, which last week was seen to be dead, is now been resurrected. So we'll have to wait and see which of these plans is eventually going to emerge. There is some traction, I think, behind the McConnell plan, which would allow the president the authority to, on his own, raise the debt ceiling. But we'll have to wait and see what happens this week. It's very interesting.
Well, it seems to me that it's never a good sign when the negotiations go public. Long as they can keep everything behind closed doors and forget about the cameras and the posturing, things get done. But as soon as the debate gets out into the public, then we don't seem to get anywhere. Is that your impression?
Yeah,
as well?
I think you've got a point there. I think what we're seeing is a lot of political posturing on both sides here. Both of them, I think, are a little bit reticent to alienate elements of their base, and so you've got all the politics, I think, at this time, sort of intervening in the process. My take is they're going to have to reach some kind of an agreement. It may come down to the wire. It may be at the last minute, a sort of midnight deal, but something's going to have to occur. I don't think either side politically can allow this to go on without some kind of resolution.
But it seems to me that the Republicans have a pretty significant problem with the so-called debt deniers or debt kamikazes in their own party, saying, hey, you know, default, we don't care. It doesn't matter. It isn't going to affect us. That's just a hoax. It's got to be a pretty big challenge for John Boehner in the House, particularly, to get his troops to line up behind anything other than what the ideologues are insisting on.
I think that's absolutely correct. This is clearly one of the impacts of the Tea Party movement surge in the fall 2010 elections. Many of those who entered Congress on those pledges to hold the line on spending are, as you say, just holding the line on this whole idea and are not at all averse to letting the debt ceiling, raising the debt ceiling lapse. I think it's problematic. I don't believe that most Republicans, and particularly in the leadership, are going to allow that to occur. But we'll have to see how it plays out. It's clear that Tea Party element of Republicans in the House, particularly, is certainly holding the leadership's feet to the fire.
Well, the governors were meeting in Utah, and they're all both Democrat and Republican are pretty frustrated with Washington's failure to act. Of course, the discussion fell along party lines, but nobody's happy with what's going on, and yet the situation kind of just continues to be stalemate.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's why I think what's going to eventually happen is, you know, before we get to the point where we have the kind of default, I believe some kind of agreement will be reached. What exactly that will be remains to be seen.
800-486-8655 is the number to call if you want to join the program this morning and give us your thoughts on the political news of the day. Right now, we're talking about the debate over increasing the debt ceiling. That's the big political story in Washington. There are dozens, literally dozens of stories. We will probably not get to every topic this hour, but give us a call at 800-486-8655, and we'll hear what you have to say. You can also send an email. The address is talk@wpr.org. And you can find the Kathleen Dunn program on Facebook. Go to the Facebook fan page and leave a comment there, and we'll read it on the radio. So your take, the debt ceiling deal is going to get done. We just won't know probably till the last minute what it's actually going to look like. I guess the definition of compromise is something no one likes. Everybody's got to give on something, and right now nobody wants to give on anything.
That's exactly right. As I say, it's the political posturing right now, and as you indicated earlier, as soon as this stuff takes place in front of the TV cameras, both sides want to posture to their political base, and I think when push comes to shove and we get down to the wire, they're going to have to reach some kind of an agreement, because allowing the United States to default on its obligations would be catastrophic for the economy. I think there is with the exception of some of those ideologues in the Tea Party movement, I think most people would agree, and certainly the experts agree, that the impact of a default would be catastrophic, not only to the United States economy, but to the world economy.
All right, we already have callers on the line, and we'll get to those in just a moment. We'll be probably continuing to talk off and on about this issue through the rest of the hour. One of the things that's been happening, of course, is that the 2012 presidential field has already been weighing in on this issue. Lots of comments. I recall Tim Pawlenty saying, hey, go ahead and let the default happen, more or less.
Yep.
One of those. There are a number of other Republican presidential contenders who are campaigning in Iowa who are talking like that. How important, I wanted to use that to morph in or to segue to this, how important are the Iowa caucuses these days in terms of their impact on the presidential nominating process? I mean, that was at one time, if you didn't win in Iowa, you didn't win, but that certainly wasn't true for John McCain. How important is Iowa? How much should we be paying attention to the caucuses?
Well, I agree. Iowa, I don't think, has the same kind of importance for the nomination as it once did. However, I will say this. Because Iowa is so early and because it uses that caucus format in choosing delegates to the conventions, and then this year, obviously, the Republican convention, the person that is most organized on the ground is the person that's likely to do well in Iowa. And the other thing about Iowa is that it allows for a candidate to really take off in terms of the fundraising, visibility in the media, and it gives that candidate who wins in Iowa at least some momentum as we go forward in the primary process. So while I don't think Iowa is as important as it once was, I clearly think it does remain an important event politically, because, as I say, whoever wins Iowa is going to have some momentum and some fundraising ability that'll establish a kind of credibility as a real candidate going forward.
Well, let's go to the phones and take some calls, because a lot of people want to talk about these issues. And
sure.
We'll start with Dave in Menominee, Michigan. Dave, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, I think the debt ceiling is going to be raised, but I think Republicans are going to stall. They're going to do whatever they can to try to create the uncertainty that they talk about a lot. They'll probably let the market fall 500 points or so. Then they'll pass the debt ceiling, which we shouldn't have to begin with. And then they're going to blame the economy falling, Wall Street dropping, on the president's policies. I wanted to get your guest comments on that.
Well, I think that's probably what they will attempt to do. I think it's also clear, and even Senator McConnell made mention of the fact that there is a risk for Republicans in allowing this to happen, because it will give them essentially co-ownership of a bad economy. And clearly we see in a number of the poll results that have been that came out last week and over the weekend that many in the public are thinking that it is Republicans who are to blame for the impasse here, largely because they won't accept the president's proposals on increasing revenues by raising the tax rates on the very wealthy and the corporations. And so I think you're right, the caller's right, that that's what Republicans will try to do. I think, however, there's a significant risk to Republicans in taking, as Mitch McConnell said, co-ownership of a bad economy.
Dave, thanks for the call. One thing, this story that came out of the governor's conference in Salt Lake City, the head of the Democratic Governors Association has actually accused GOP debt negotiators in Washington of trying to undermine the economy, so that President Barack Obama will lose his reelection bid next year. That seems to be in line with what Dave is saying. The Republicans, of course, say that's hogwash.
Yeah, and I think you know what that comment is pointing to those particular Tea Party Republicans who have, as you pointed out, Tim Pawlenty and even Michelle Bachmann have come out and said, well, you know, let the debt ceiling lapse. It's not going to have this kind of devastating impact. We'll wait and see. You know, I don't think that's likely to happen. But I think, as I've said before, most of the experts say that letting that happen would be catastrophic. You know, it's really sad that we have this kind of playing with the economy and the lives and fortunes of the American public in order to make political points and political gains. And I think that's really risky for Republicans, because as much as they are seen as doing that, I think won't resonate very well with the American public.
Dave, thanks for the call. Let's go to Milwaukee next and hear what Michael has to say. Michael, good morning.
Morning. First of all, I have to agree with that first caller. You know, let's face it, the Republicans want to make President Obama look as bad as possible. They want his to be a failing presidency, and whatever they can do to make it look, make him look as bad as possible, even at risk of bringing the country down, I mean, they're just going to do it. And one of the things I wanted to say is one of the things that got us into this problem is, of course, the Bush tax cuts and fighting a couple of wars without paying for those wars. And it's part of this philosophy of starve the beast. You know, let's cut funding, and then when things get trouble, we'll have to do something to fix it. We'll take all the money away, just like they're doing with the school systems. But one other thing that I wanted to touch on is all this concern about the budget deficit and the debt ceiling, but why don't we hear any talking or complaining about this trade deficit? I'll tell you what, this trade deficit, in my estimation, is going to be more detrimental to the country than owing money to ourselves. So I'd like to hear something on that.
Thanks for the call, Michael. Well, let's take both of those points. Maybe the second one first is no one paying attention. No one's paying attention to the trade deficit these days.
Well, I think that, you know, there are people who are very concerned and paying attention about the trade deficit. I think what has obviously come center stage with the current discussion is the debt ceiling. But the caller is absolutely correct. The trade deficit is a huge problem, and it is something that clearly needs to be addressed by Congress. The problem is, you see, if we're having this kind of an impasse over raising the debt ceiling, imagine the kind of discussion and imagine the kind of political wrangling that would occur when we get into discussions about how to deal with the trade deficit. These are major, major problems, and it really is unfortunate, I think, that that so much of the political posturing has now sort of invaded what ought to be a real serious look at how we arrive at solutions to what are some very, very significant fiscal problems for the United States.
What about Michael's other point that what we don't hear enough about is the role of the fact that we had two unfunded wars and rather significant tax cuts that, you know, we aren't hearing about that now so much?
Well, he clearly makes a valid point. I think there is some discussion, and that's being trotted out among some, particularly on the left, that the Bush tax cuts for families making over $250,000 a year should be allowed to expire in 2013. As part of any debt reduction deal. But of course, you know that will be spun by the Republicans as a tax increase. And, you know, that seems to resonate with a significant element in the population. Anytime you talk about raising taxes, it does sort of resonate with many voters. But again, I stand by my statement that I think there is a risk for Republicans, in as much as they'll be seen as the ones who are standing in the way of reaching some kind of an accommodation here. And it's always very difficult for Republicans to try to make the case that the wealthy and the large corporations ought not to pitch in and pay their share. And I think there is a big risk for Republicans in allowing the debt ceiling or the default to occur.
All right, we'll get back to some more phone calls in just a moment. You're listening to All Things Political on the Kathleen Dunn Program. John Munson in for Kathleen for the next couple of weeks. My guest this morning is George Waller, professor of political science at UW Fox Valley, We'll be taking more of your calls in just a moment. I'm John Munson. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 22 minutes after 9 o'clock, John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Here's what's coming up later on today on the Ideas Network. Talk of the Nation after 1, with talks on the debt limit going nowhere and the August 2nd deadline looming, some worry what could happen if they don't make a deal. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke says nothing good. Who gets paid? Who doesn't? After 1 on Talk of the Nation, what default might mean to the economy. That's coming up later today here on Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, it's all things political, and my guest is George Waller, professor of political science at UW-Fox Valley. Let's go back to the phones. It's our day. It's Monday for Michael's here. This time, Michael in Menasha. Michael, good morning.
Good morning. Professor Waller, when I heard you were the guest, I couldn't resist calling in. I was hoping you could maybe talk about the Republican candidates for president and maybe give us an idea of who you feel might gain the most traction over the coming year, maybe even somebody that's not technically in the race yet.
Well, hi, Michael. I think I recognize your voice. But I'll tell you what, I think there is some concern on the part of some Republicans as to the sort of surge in support for Michelle Bachmann's candidacy. And I think what we're likely to see is that there's going to be some encouragement for other candidates to enter the Republican race. My take is, and I think you could probably take this to the bank and put a bet down in Las Vegas, that Governor Perry of Texas is going to probably throw his hat in the ring. And I think that would present a real challenge to Michelle Bachmann. Governor Perry is very much a conservative and very much in many ways akin to Michelle Bachmann, but not quite as strident and probably seen as a bit more of an attractive candidate for many of the mainstream Republicans. I'm sort of interested that John Huntsman's campaign hasn't taken off the way I thought it might. He obviously, as the former ambassador to China under Barack Obama, seemed to me to be a candidate that might really appeal to the establishment Republicans, perhaps not so much with the Tea Party Republicans, but we're going to really have to wait and see, and I think Iowa's going to be a first test once those caucuses take place as to which candidates have been winnowed out and which ones remain standing as viable candidates when we go forward. But again, look for Governor Perry of Texas to throw his hat in the ring very soon.
Well, what about John Huntsman? I mean, he has an extremely wealthy and very powerful family behind him, his father in particular, very well connected. But do the mainstream Republicans or the traditional Republican leadership, do they matter as much in today's atmosphere? Are they in danger of losing control of their own party?
Well, it's clear, and one of the problems, of course, in any primary season is that it's the energized base of the party that really is quite powerful in at least in early primaries in establishing credible candidacies, and I think that's why we see Michelle Bachmann doing so well in Iowa. Huntsman's candidacy is very interesting. I think what we need to see is we need to see another debate in which John Huntsman participates and where people can compare those Republican candidates once again as they did earlier and see who rises to the top. But I think you're right. There are those very conservative Tea Party Republicans who are at least controlling to some extent the agenda and controlling, obviously, the focus of attention by the media.
Recently, Huntsman has had to kind of recraft his image on environmental issues. He's been accused of being too liberal on those, and so he's had to kind of remake himself. It seems to me you have to run to the right or the left in the primary, right, to get to the nomination, and then you run back to the center once the general election is on. The word on the street is Huntsman is a candidate that Barack Obama is most concerned about.
Well, I believe so, because I believe John Huntsman represents a real sort of more moderate, sort of centrist Republican traditional candidate. But again, as much as that very ultra-conservative Tea Party element of the Republican Party has been able to capture the attention and clearly the momentum, is somewhat problematic for an establishment candidate like John Huntsman.
All right. Thanks for the call, Michael in Menasha. Let's go next to Brown Deer and hear what Earl has to say. Earl, good morning.
Hello. I'd like to ask Professor Waller, what would be the ramifications of a default by our government? Would our money be secure in the bank if the FDIC rules didn't apply anymore because the government's gone broke?
Well, I can tell you some of the things that people are saying are likely to happen in terms of your finances, the finances of regular Americans. I mean, if the government defaults, what it would mean is that the government would be able to pay about 56% of its bills, but the other 44% the government would not be able to pay, which means that people who rely on government checks, benefit checks, paychecks, may or may not get them after August 2nd. We would have to see which of those payments government would be able to do and which would not. Right now, it doesn't appear as Social Security and unemployment checks would be going out as they normally do if there were a default. Another thing, interest rates would likely rise precipitously. That means higher rates on your credit cards, on your home mortgages, any loans, student loans, which will make it quite problematic for many people to sort of meet those general obligations. Investment would clearly take a hit. The economy would be pushed back into a recession. The stock market's very likely to tank. That obviously would put pressure on companies in terms of hiring and jobs. They would likely now be hit again in a negative way. So clearly, I think people's personal finances would be affected, and it's very, very likely, especially if that default would last for just more than a few days, that we'd have a significant downturn and more than just a recession, perhaps even precipitating a real depression for the U.S. economy. And that isn't even to mention the impact that would have worldwide if the United States went into default.
Earl, thanks for the call. Jim in Milwaukee, you're next.
Good morning, Jim. I have a few quick comments. First of all, we really need to stop saying the Bush tax cuts. December 6, 2010, President Obama announced a compromise tax package that included $56 billion in unemployment and an approximate $120 billion in payroll taxes for working-class families and $40 billion for the hardest-hit families and students. They became his. So he did that with a full majority in the Senate and the House. Also, once they decide how much people are allowed to keep, that doesn't change anything for the 45 to 50% of the people who aren't paying any federal taxes right now. They're still paying the same, zero. So it's only the other 50% that will be paying. And my question is, if the Democrats say $3 in reduction for every $1 in revenue, why not just go $2 in reduction? You still got the same result.
Well, whether you want to call them the Bush tax cuts or the Obama tax cuts, the notion is obviously that those tax cuts were originally proposed and passed into law under President Bush. And the caller's correct that they have been reiterated under Obama with the support of the Congress, and I think largely because of the election results in 2010, which clearly put the White House in a position where it knew it had to work with a Republican Congress. In terms of the actual, whether it's $3 or two to one in terms of debts, in terms of spending reductions and revenue increases, again, these are things that have sort of been bandied back and forth, and until we see exactly what they're going to arrive at, it'll be interesting to watch. I know that there are many on the conservative side who don't want any revenue increases. I mean, certainly Eric Cantor, the majority leader in the House, is clearly opposed to any revenue increases, and I think he represents that conservative Tea Party element who are opposed to any kind of revenue increases through taxation. But again, we'll see what's going to happen with that. I think we're at an impasse, and we're heading towards that fateful date of August 2nd, and we'll have to see just exactly what the balance will be, if there will be one, between revenue increases and spending reductions.
Jim, thanks for that call. It's All Things Political on this Monday morning, the 18th of July, 2011. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. My guest is George Waller, professor of political science at UW Fox Valley. A reminder that if you call and get a busy signal, you can always send an email to talk at WPR.org or leave a comment on the Kathleen Dunn Facebook show page, and we'll repeat it here on the air. All right, back to the phones, and this time it's Bill in Madison. Bill, good morning.
Well, I have a brief comment and a question. First, what the last caller was saying, 40 to 50% of the workforce isn't pay, or families are not paying any income taxes at all. I hear that number bandied about quite a bit, and I question it very strongly. I'm very skeptical of it. But just assuming that it's true, that just gives fuel to the idea that the middle class in this country is disappearing thanks to globalization, thanks to the policies of both Democratic and Republican parties over the past 20 years. Now, what my question is I've heard Tea Party members mention that, especially our own governor here in Wisconsin, mentioned in the less guarded moments that they don't think that the business of government should be things like public schools or Social Security, that if they had their way, those things would not be discut, they would be gone. So if the Tea Party's real agenda is not cuts, they want essentially to gut them and then ultimately eliminate them so that there will be no public schools in this country, no Social Security, no social safety nets of any kind. They basically believe that the government's only job is the Defense Department. I'd like your comments off the air.
Well, I certainly do believe that there are some on the right who do, in fact, feel the way the caller characterizes it, that they do believe that government should not be in the business of doing these entitlement programs and the like. And I think there are those on the right who are, advocates of the kind of ultimate privatization of all services, where people will pay for their own schools, will pay for their own garbage collection, they'll pay for the kinds of things that government provides via taxes. And I think, that's the kind of thing we need to have some discussion about. I mean, this idea that taxes are a negative and taxes are a bad thing, which you hear quite often from some on that side, one has to understand just exactly what taxes do pay for and what they do provide. And when we get down to that discussion, it'll be very interesting to see whether the American public, and the middle class in particular, would come out on the side of sort of privatizing all of the kinds of things we currently get by way of services from government. I don't think, however, that's going to resonate a great deal with the American public, and I don't think most of the serious leaders of either party really take that kind of a extremist position. Although I think the caller's right, there are some who clearly do take that kind of a position.
Bill, thanks for the call. Professor, going back just for a moment to the presidential campaign, there was a kind of a side note to all of this, an appearance by Herman Cain on Fox News Sunday, where he says American communities have the right to ban mosques. What did you make of that?
Yeah, I did notice that. I think it was a community in Tennessee that had stood in the way of allowing Muslims to worship in certain areas, and Herman Cain came out foursquare in support of the people in that community who did not want to allow Muslim worship in their neighborhoods. I'm very intrigued by why Herman Cain would take that kind of a position. I don't think that's the kind of position that will resonate well with the majority of American voters. I think most people are very much in support of what's ensconced in the First Amendment, freedom of religion, and to have this kind of standing in the way of allowing people to worship as they see fit, I just don't see that as a winning position for a candidate going into a presidential election year.
All right. At some point, I'd like to get to some Wisconsin state issues, but people want to talk about other stuff, and so we'll I'll bow to the will of the audience here. Let's go to Boulder Junction next and hear from Morris.
Boris.
Hello. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Hello.
Yes, you're on. Go ahead.
Professor, you made a comment earlier that not raising the debt ceiling would be catastrophic. Instead of enumerating what you hear on the Sunday morning talk shows, would you give two specific events with detail that are catastrophic? And student loans is hardly catastrophic.
Well, you may not think student loan interest rates would be catastrophic, although it depends upon one's point of view. Certainly those who rely on student loans to allow their children to seek higher education would view that as something particularly problematic. But I'm not talking just about interest rates on student loans. Interest rates across the board would rise, and that would mean all of credit card interest rates, home mortgages, auto loans, all of those things would clearly be adversely affected in terms of a significant increase. The borrowing capacity of American families would seriously go down. Business investment, which of course would mean less hiring, would go down as a result of those kinds of significant increases. And as I said, you know, if the impasse lasts for more than a few days, there likely would be a very negative impact on the stock market. And, you know, a serious loss of confidence in the U.S. government worldwide and the U.S.'s ability to meet its debt obligations would also be problematic. You know, when you find that people like Ben Bernanke and even people, leaders in both the Republican and Democratic parties and leading economists say that allowing the United States to default on its obligations would present a real catastrophic impact on not only the United States economy, but the global financial system. I mean, the credit ratings of the credit rating agencies would downgrade U.S. Treasuries and would have a significant impact on the United States' status in the world economy. Again, I know there are some, and I think the caller is clearly one of them, who don't believe that these kinds of things will in fact occur and are essentially betting on the notion that we should just let the United States default and see where the chips fall. But I think when you have leading economists and you have even the leadership in both parties saying, you know, we cannot afford to allow this to happen, and serious consequences that have already been made apparent from foreign governments and from the credit rating agencies as to what the impact would be on the fiscal situation of the United States, I think, you know, you want to call that bluff and you want to let that happen. I suppose if that's your position, you'll have to see where the chips will fall. But my take is that there will be a serious impact on hiring, a negative impact on hiring, a serious impact on rising interest rates, and a serious impact on the ability of the United States government to meet its obligations in terms of Social Security and other government payments. So we'll see.
All right, Boris, thanks for the call. We're working our way through all things political on this Monday morning. My guest is George Waller, professor of political science at UW Fox Valley. Lines are full. We'll keep taking calls in just a moment. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9:41, almost 9:42. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Stick around after 10 o'clock. It's robots. Scientists are working to make robots more human-like in motion and perception. Next hour, my guest and I will talk about how close science is to making a robot that's more like us. So, great big geek alert on next hour, and I'm really looking forward to it. My guest this hour is George Waller, and he is a professor of political science at UW Fox Valley. We're talking about all things political, lots of calls and lots of stuff to get to and not a whole lot of time. So this is the portion of the hour where we put out a call to everybody, including the host, to be perhaps a little less loquacious. Let's take Cindy in Burlington next. Cindy, good morning.
Good morning. My question is, this debt ceiling, isn't it like having a credit card, and the credit card company only gives you a $10,000 limit, and once you call them and ask them, oh, can I have a $10,000, you know, go over $10,000, they're saying no. You know, and there's like no more new spending. Now you have to start paying that down. Why are we raising the debt? Why can't we live, like, right there? What new spending is going to be putting us over this debt? And my comment is, they should have, or put a new regulation law, whatever, that the first people that get their checks cut are the ones that are in Congress now, because they're the ones that are not doing their jobs. So they're the first ones that don't get a check. So I'll take my comments and answer off the air. Thank you.
Well, again, you can make that kind of analogy, but I think clearly the case is, and I think everybody agrees, that something needs to be done about controlling spending. But to allow the government to allow the debt ceiling to lapse and the government to default by not allowing the government to be able to borrow money in order to meet its obligations, it has a much broader impact nationwide than it would be for any individual who's denied more money by a credit card company. I mean, we're talking here about the government not being able to meet its obligations with about 44% of the bills that the government regularly needs to make payments on essentially being defaulted. That's an estimated $134 billion that the federal government won't be able to pay out. On an annualized basis, that we're talking about almost $1.6 trillion, which is nearly all of the discretionary spending that government currently can do. And that includes spending for defense. I mean, we're talking about something that's significantly more broad in its impact than one's individual credit card. In terms of, the checks not being cut to members of Congress because they're not doing their job, it would be up to lawmakers to come up with a kind of prioritization of the kinds of things that government ought to pay and what not to pay. And it seems highly unlikely that you're going to have members of Congress saying that their checks ought to be the first ones on the table. And even if they were, the impact would be so minimal in terms of, it might be symbolically important, but in terms of an actual fiscal impact, it's really next to nothing.
Thanks for the call. Let's go next to Kurt in Madison. Kurt, good morning.
Good morning. I have a comment first and then the question. The comment, which frustrates me, is politicians and pundits, including as well as our president, have used the word entitlements. Now, from my understanding, it's not an entitlement. It's an insurance. We all pay for it. It's not something that comes to us free because someone agreed to it. Could the professor please explain why the shift has gone to entitlement?
They're called entitlements because they're programs that pay benefits to people who are covered under the particular act. I mean, Social Security payments are called entitlements. Whether you like the term or not, I mean, that's where they've been categorized. The same is true for veterans benefits and the like. Medicare, Medicaid, those are what are generally classified as entitlement programs, because those who qualify under the act that instituted those programs are entitled to the benefits that are included in the act. As long as you qualify, you're entitled to those benefits. And I think that's where the term entitlements comes. There's a lot of debate and a lot of discussion about what to do about for lack of a better term, entitlement programs, because a significant portion of the federal budget is in fact taken up by what we classify as entitlements. And you really can't get a handle on the deficit unless you do something about what are called entitlement programs. So we'll see what's going to shake out with this. And I think it's emblematic of the kind of real significant and substantive discussion we ought to be having, rather than the political discussion that tends to dominate Congress and in the media.
I'd like to move us along in just a moment to a couple of state issues that are out there. One is the upcoming recall elections and the proposed redistricting that has passed at least one Senate panel. I'd like to get to those. And so I'm going to give the phone numbers again, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. You can send an email to talk@WPR.org, but I'd like to get some comments how people are feeling about the recent primary elections where all of the pseudo-Democrats were defeated. Now we'll get the real recall elections very shortly, and also on redistricting. And then there's also a new poll out that says 59% of citizens in Wisconsin disapprove of Governor Walker's performance to date. I'd like to hear what people think about those issues. But first, though, we'll take one more call on the national stuff, and it'll be Al in Milwaukee. Al, good morning.
Yeah, hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Go ahead. I think we lost Al.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Professor, I'll get your take on some of these things first. Let's talk about the recall elections. Of course, this the result of the huge, huge controversy over Governor Walker's budget repair bill, Wisconsin Act 10. We had the Wisconsin 14 and all of the protests in February and March and on into April. And now we have recall election. There were a number of fake Democrats who ran to force a primary. They were all defeated. Now we actually get the real recall elections coming up. Talk about that. How do you handicap these races?
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, clearly, the fake Democrats, the so-called fake Democrats, were put forward by the Republican Party in order to delay the general election in those particular districts where Republican senators are facing recall, allowing them to have an extra month or so to raise money and to campaign. And as you said, all of those so-called fake Democrats lost by rather large margins in all of those districts. There's going to be some interesting races, I think. One to watch in particular is the race between Shelley Moore, who defeated Isaac Weichs, the fake Democrat in District 10, facing Sheila Harsdorf of River Falls. That one is drawing a lot of attention. Currently, the spending in that race has topped $750,000 and is likely to go even higher. So that's one to watch. I think we're going to see a real close election in that race. The other one,
really,
I think that is of particular interest is the race between Sandy Posh and Alberta Darling in State Senate District 8. Recent polls tend to show that one as really neck and neck, and I think both candidates clearly understand that there's a real race in that particular district. I think the candidate or the Republican incumbent who probably is in the toughest race for recall race is Randy Hopper in State Senate District 18. Jessica King's candidacy seems to have taken on a real momentum in that particular district, and I would say that at this point Jessica King probably has the momentum and probably is in a good position vis-a-vis Randy Hopper. Dan Kopanky in Senate District 32 may also face a particularly a tough race against his Democratic opponent, Jennifer Schilling. She won by a very, very comfortable margin against the fake Democrat. So I think in those places in particular, I would say that Democrats have a real shot of defeating the incumbent Republicans. I think in the other, Luther Olson, I think, probably is going to defeat Fred Clark. You've seen a lot of spending by the Republicans and by groups that support Luther Olson in that district to sort of marginalize Fred Clark as a candidate. So that's how I essentially see those six races. Hansen, I think, is likely to go on in the Green Bay area and defeat David Vanderleest. I think it will be a rather lopsided election in Dave Hansen's favor. And then we'll have to wait and see what happens with those District 12 and District 22 after the Republican primaries to see who will face Jim Holprin and Robert Wirch. I think Holprin may be in those races that will take place on August 16th, the Democratic senator who may be in the most precarious position in terms of a recall. But we'll have to wait and see how that takes place once the Republicans in that district nominate a candidate.
I was really surprised to hear what you had to say about Sheila Harsdorf, because that seems to be a real change in that district. Because going into this thing, everybody that I talked to from that area said, hey, this is pretty solidly Republican. A lot of it, most of that district is a bedroom community for the Twin Cities. That when she shouldn't have any trouble. But you're suggesting that she may be in some difficulty.
Yeah, and I think because you're seeing a lot of money pumped into that race. And I think this is a race that's been nationalized to some extent. Clearly one of the factors that explains the high cost of that race is that those candidates need to essentially use the Twin Cities media market to do a lot of their advertising. But I think, you know, money often plays a very important role, and I think you're going to find that may be one of those races to sort of look at on election night on coming up on what is it, the 19th? August 9th.
Okay, let's take a quick call here from Steve, who's on the road. Steve, good morning.
Good morning. Can you hear me then?
Yes, go ahead.
I want your guest's reaction to the idea that the Democrats need to distance themselves from the sole issue of collective bargaining, the Republican agenda in the state office is so broadly antagonistic to an awful lot of things that Wisconsin has stood for over the years. I'll take your comments off the air because I can't hear you. I hope you got through. Hey, bye.
Bye. Thanks, Steve.
Yeah, I think it is interesting that one of the things we're seeing is that these recall campaigns have now branched out into issues that are far beyond the fight over collective bargaining, which is, of course, the issue that sparked these races. You're now seeing that a lot of the ads that are airing are talking about candidates' personal histories, legal problems, and then, you know, beyond that, there are broader questions about the battle over the state budget and even into federal issues like what to do about Medicare. And I think the reason for that is I think both parties understand that opinion on the collective bargaining issue has pretty much crystallized, and you're not going to change people's minds on that issue. So what you need to do is you need to, at least in your advertising, in your campaigns, try to find those who you might be able to reach or resonate with on other issues, the personal histories, the legal problems, the state budget, federal issues, and the like. And I think that's why we're seeing that. But the caller is absolutely correct that fight over collective bargaining has taken a kind of secondary status in the campaigns and the advertising that we've seen in these recalls.
All right. Thanks a lot, Steve. I want to quickly get to the redistricting issue because that's huge and maybe bigger than people think. One Senate panel has passed the Republican plan, which they spent a lot of legal fees on, and I think that the taxpayers actually paid those. The Assembly is planning on meeting an extraordinary session to vote on redistricting. Obviously, the Republicans want to get this plan in place before the recall elections because they may be concerned about losing control of the state Senate. Democrats are not happy. Give us your take, Professor.
Well, that's absolutely right. Republicans are very keen on getting their redistricting plan passed into law. They have the ability to do that. They are the majority in both chambers of the state legislature, and it is always the case in the cycle that follows a census year that the parties in the state legislature, in particular the majority party in the state legislature, has the opportunity to redraw not only congressional district boundaries but state legislative district boundaries. And it is always the case, whether it's a Republican majority or a Democratic majority, that majority party will try to draw those district boundaries in a way that benefits their party politically. And so Republicans clearly have put forward a redistricting plan both for the congressional districts in the state and for the state legislative districts that are drawn with an eye towards creating more likelihood that Republicans will be elected from those districts. And obviously, as you rightly pointed out, they want this passed into law and to become the actual redistricting plan in Wisconsin before those recall elections take place, with the possibility of the Democrats taking over in the Senate, which would throw that redistricting plan into a completely different kind of political environment. So So we'll wait and see whether there will be anything that Democrats can do in either the state Senate and the state assembly prior to those recall elections to stop that plan from going forward. But my guess is Republican legislature will pass that plan, and it will become the new redistricting plan for the state of Wisconsin.
Well, we're just about out of time. Very quickly, though, maybe in 30 seconds or so, a new poll out says 59% of Wisconsinites disapprove of Governor Walker's performance. He said he doesn't care much about polls. Do you think it makes any difference at this point?
Well, yeah, you know, perhaps not for Governor Walker's fortunes, but I think it may be something that those Republican candidates in those Senate recall elections are looking at, because whenever you see that kind of a poll number on the chief executive of a state, it doesn't sit too well with members of that particular person's party.
All right. And that's where we'll have to leave it, Professor. Thanks so much for your time. George Waller, Professor of Political Science at UW Fox Valley. Rhonda Fanning produced this program. Chrissy Pease handled on-air production. Stick around. We're going to talk about robots after the news coming up next from National Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network.